any voyager. And so he writes that Odysseus, wishing to return home, was instructed by the nymph Calypso to keep rightward of the Great Bear, the constellation that, alone of them all, never takes a bath in the ocean. Indo-European languages have long distinguished Orient, rising east, from Occident, setting west. The Greeks differentiated sunrise and sunset at the solstices from those at the equinoxes, creating six directions from two. The Vikings, sailing from Scandinavia into the sea, differentiated landward from oceanward. Land south and land north were easterly directions. Out south and out north were westerly. For early navigators in low latitudes, such as the Mediterranean and the Arabian Sea, the points at which the sun rose and set were useful direction markers year-round. Whereas for the Vikings, who lived at high latitudes, those points changed too drastically from month to month to be helpful. The closer a mariner sailed to the North Pole, the harder it was to gain his bearings from the sun or the stars, and the more he had to rely on winds, birds, and tides, though he could consult Polaris as a reliable rough indicator of north. Pacific Islanders took another tack. Voyaging across Oceania, they steered their course by cavengas, or star paths, arcs described by the successive risings or settings of a series of familiar stars. These arcs would guide them from one known island to another. 3, 4, and 5 millennia ago, large numbers of slow, big-bellied merchant ships crisscrossed the Old World waterways, carrying both luxuries and necessities. But merchants had neither the seas nor the harbors to themselves. By 2400 BC, Egyptian armies were being ferried to what is now the coast of Lebanon. By 2000 BC, the first true maritime power of the Mediterranean, the Minoans, inhabitants of the island of Crete, had built itself a navy. By 1300 BC, fleets of marauding northerners were seizing ships and blockading naval bases that the pharaoh Thutmose III had established along the Lebanese coast. From the earliest centuries of maritime commerce, writes the historian Lionel Casson, the freighter had to share the seas with the man of war. Piracy, plunder, and the taking of slaves increased in direct proportion to trade, travel, and the taking of land. Seaborne raids on both vessels and coastal settlements became commonplace. Sea battles increased in scale and complexity. Meanwhile, the hunger for foreign goods mounted. Athens' Achilles' heel, exploited in war by both Sparta and Macedon, was its dependence on grain shipped from Egypt, Sicily, and southern Russia. An amazing range and quantity of cargo was carried across the seas in ancient times. In the 3rd millennium BC, South Asian gold, ivory, carnelian, and lapis lazuli, Lebanese cedar, and Omani and Cypriot copper changed hands at the eastern Mediterranean port of Byblos, at the Persian Gulf port of Bahrain, and at the mouths of the Indus River. Frankincense and myrrh from the Horn of Africa were ferried up the Red Sea to Egypt. Lapis lazuli from Harappan settlements in the Indus Valley also made its way to Egypt. Fragments of Indian teak appear in the ruins of the Sumerian city of Ur. Minoan craftsmen worked amber from the Baltic. Mycenaean jars arrived at the palace of the pharaoh Akhenaten. Chinese silk was woven into the hair of Egyptian mummies. Sri Lankan cinnamon bark scented the women of Arabia. Zimbabwean gold crossed the Indian Ocean long before Europeans staked claims in southern Africa. Han Chinese rulers had such need of war horses that they imported the beasts both by land and by sea. Each year, freighters transported hundreds of tons of wheat, olive oil, marble, and herb-laden fish sauce to Athens, to Rome, to Alexandria. Local versions of fermented shrimp paste, a staple condiment in the cuisines of Southeast Asia, made their way across the South China Sea. A single merchant vessel wrecked in the 1st century BC near Albenga on the Italian coast between Genoa and Monaco held between 11,000 and 13,500 amphorae of wine. The Bronze Age made tin a prized commodity. Generally, an alloy of copper and tin, bronze was a brilliant invention, a strong, corrosion-resistant material that could be cast at relatively low temperatures into weapons, ritual vessels, ornaments, statues, and tools. The intimidating rams at the prows of the warships that kept the seas open for the merchant ships were made of bronze. But since copper and tin are rarely found in the same patch of Earth's crust, long-distance trade was essential to their union. And since tin could fetch many times the price of copper, it was definitely worth a trader's time and effort. By the 8th century BC, the search for tin, as well as for silver and gold, had taken the Phoenicians through the Pillars of Hercules and the Strait of Gibraltar at the western exit from the Mediterranean and onward to the Atlantic side of the Iberian Peninsula to an area called Tartessos. Some tin could be extracted locally there, but much more was transported overland from major sources farther north, including Cornwall, the southwestern tip of Britain, to which Herodotus seems to have been referring when he wrote in the mid-5th century BC of the Ten Islands, whence the tin comes which we use. To Herodotus, those places, unglimpsed by him and everyone he'd ever met, were the ends of the earth. One reason none of his acquaintances had seen those sources of tin firsthand was that the navy of Carthage, the strong North African colony planted by the Phoenicians, had blockaded the Strait of Gibraltar. Nevertheless, little more than a century after Herodotus wrote those words, a daring Greek from Massalia named Pytheas may well have made his way to the Atlantic Ocean, the tin works of Cornwall, and much else besides. Massalia, Marseille, was the colony of a colony, one of many Greek and Phoenician maritime cities that sprouted across and beyond the full breadth of the Mediterranean from the early to the middle of the first millennium BC. During those centuries, the founding of colonies and the forging of trade routes proceeded hand in hand with the development of warships and the establishment of navies. Alongside all that commerce and conflict, inquiry and learning flourished as well. Interchange took place on every coast. Information poured in from every direction. Anaximander, a resident of the thriving Greek city of Miletus, drew the first map of the inhabited regions of Earth. Soon afterward, Hecateus of Miletus improved upon Anaximander's map and produced a comprehensive geography of the known world. A donut-shaped collage of landmasses, a flat map of a flat earth with the Mediterranean, literally Middle Earth, at its heart and the continuous ocean at its outer boundary. Soon after that, a globe-trotting mathematician astronomer named Eudoxus of Cnidus wrote his own work of geography and also devised a model of planetary motion, presenting it as an interconnected system of 27 spheres, each of which rotated on an axis that passed through the center of Earth. Pytheas thus came of age in a cosmopolitan, contentious, intellectually active world that grew larger, more acquisitive, and more fact-hungry by the day. How he got past the Pillars of Hercules is much debated. That he did so is generally accepted, as is the contention that he saw Cornwall and followed the west coast of Britain north to the Orkney Islands with a stopover at the Isle of Man. What some scholars do dispute is whether Pytheas himself then voyaged 6 days north to a place the ancients called Thule, which might be Iceland, and thence almost up to the Arctic Circle. Let us be believers. Let us say Pytheas did all the things his advocates say he did. So during his voyage, besides searching out tin, he periodically measured the height of the sun, recorded the shadows cast by a gnomon at various locations, gasped at the prodigious tides of the Pentland Firth, counted the number of islands in the Orkney group, and took note of the houses, crops, and beverages of the communities he visited. In Thule, at the outskirts of the Arctic Circle, he witnessed extreme phenomena. The place where the sun lies down and straightway rises again, and the congealed sea, lying 1 day's journey from land, a region where neither earth was in existence by itself, nor sea, nor vapor, but instead a sort of mixture of these, where the earth and the sea and all things are together, suspended, existing in a form impassable by foot or ship. From Thule he traveled east in search of amber, and then south, completing his circumnavigation of Britannicae, whence Britannia, and masterfully approximating its rough perimeter as the equivalent of 4,400 modern miles. Upon returning to Massalia, he wrote a periplus, sailing around, a treatise called On the Ocean, of which not a single copy survives, only respectful paraphrases and skeptical dismissals. Pytheas wasn't the first Mediterranean mariner who reputedly entered the North Atlantic. He was just more adventurous and science-minded than his predecessors. Traditionally, the conceptual universes of navigators and scholars did not overlap. Seafarers had little truck with scientists' determinations, nor did scientists with seafarers' findings. But Pytheas's data were used by astronomers and geographers for centuries after his death, and became as useful to plunderers and conquerors as to merchants and diplomats. Hipparchus, the mathematician-astronomer who developed the framework of degrees, parallels, and meridians that is still used to describe latitude and longitude, translated into degrees of latitude Pytheas's careful measurements of gnomon shadows, hours of daylight, solar altitudes, and distances traveled. That's how we know that Pytheas placed Massalia at 43 degrees 3 minutes north, he was only a fourth of a degree off, and paused on his northward journey at 48 degrees 40 minutes north, northwestern Brittany, likely the island of Ushant in the English Channel, 54 degrees 14 minutes north, the Isle of Man, 58 degrees 13 minutes north, the island of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides, about 61 degrees, the Shetlands, and about 66 degrees, northern Iceland. Hipparchus, no mean authority himself, invoked the authority of Pytheas when correcting other scientists' blunders. Indeed, concerning the North Pole, Eudoxus certainly doesn't know what he's talking about when he says, "There is a certain star remaining always at the same place. This star is the pole of the cosmos, since no single star lies at the pole, but an empty place instead, near which lie three stars. The spot marking the pole, aided by these stars, encloses a figure very nearly resembling a quadrilateral, exactly, in fact, as Pytheas the Massaliote says." Ambitious early wayfinders reputedly also went in the other direction, south, One voyage, a several-year clockwise circumnavigation of Africa, undertaken by Phoenician mariners in about 600 BC, was initiated at the behest of the military-minded Egyptian king, Necho II. A century or more later, Hanno, the king of Carthage, took a counterclockwise route with many thousands of colonists and great numbers of vessels. How far did those voyages get? Hard to say, for sure. Hipparchus's 360-degree system of latitude and longitude, and the calculations it made possible, gave a big boost to the sciences of geography, cartography, and astronomy. The terms latitude and longitude derive from the Greek for breadth and length, respectively, denoting a binary directionality in early maps of the known world. But the difference between the two goes very deep. The American historian David Sobel describes it this way. The 0-degree parallel of latitude is fixed by the laws of nature, while the 0-degree meridian of longitude shifts like the sands of time. This difference makes finding latitude child's play and turns the determination of longitude, especially at sea, into an adult dilemma, one that stumped the wisest minds of the world for the better part of human history. Though Polaris was not yet in place to serve as a convenient North Star, the Greeks understood that if the same star or stars barely skimmed the horizon in two different cities, those cities lay at the same latitude. Latitude could be calculated from the highest altitude reached by certain cataloged stars. One that could be consulted alone or as part of a pair was Canopus, a bright southern star known in Arabic as Suhail. Eudoxus knew that Canopus, Suhail, could barely be seen in Rhodes, but hit an angle of 7.5 degrees in Alexandria. The medieval Arab navigator-poet Ahmad ibn Majid, who measured both in degrees and in uzba, the width of the knuckle of the middle finger held at arm's length against the horizon, advised his readers that when the star Aldebaran reached its highest ascent, the angle of Sahel would be 6 degrees in Sandebor, present-day Goa, and 7.75 uzba at Cape Madraka in present-day Oman. The best method of measuring latitudes is using Suhail, wrote Ibn Majid, and another like this will never be seen throughout all eternity. Eternity is a long time. In fact, it would take fewer than 1,000 years for Polaris to elbow Suhail aside and become the present century's best tool for finding latitude. Everywhere north of the equator, the elevation of Polaris above the horizon will currently locate you within a degree of your actual latitude on Earth. The bright southern star Solbear, also called Achenar, Arabic for end of the river, served as another reference point for calculations of latitude, according to Ibn Majid. The Mu'lim navigators, who spent weeks crossing the Indian Ocean in tandem with the monsoons, relied heavily on it. By your life, had it not been for Solbear, the pilots of the fig, the date, and the beetle would never have been guided. No instrument which they use over Mudwara is like it as a guide. Ibn Majid's praise of naked eye observations notwithstanding, specialized instruments have long proved valuable in navigation. Some, including the quadrant and the astrolabe, began life as land-based aids, devised by astronomers and mathematicians, and were later simplified to make them seaworthy. Foremost among readily available length-measuring devices, of course, are the independently movable parts of the human body, fingers, hands, arms, the landlubber's striding foot. In the 1150s, an Icelander who had just visited the Holy Land declared that there a man could determine the altitude of the pole star by lying on the ground, putting his fist upon his raised knee, and raising his thumb from his fist. A Venetian sailing in the 1450s for the Portuguese crown described the pole star's altitude at a certain location along the coast of West Africa as the height of a man above the sea. In the 1950s, a commodore in Britain's Royal Navy still felt free to declare that even a modern navigator might approximate the altitude of a star by consulting the span of his wrist, 8 degrees, or his hand, 18 degrees, held at arm's length. Today, too, any amateur astronomer knows that a fist held at arm's length spans 10 degrees on the sky. This system works because people with big hands tend to have longer arms, preserving the standardized angles of measurement. Early Indian Ocean navigators consulted the width of a typical knuckle, but also the kamal. In its most streamlined form, the kamal is a card-shaped piece of wood through whose center passes a piece of string, knotted at equal intervals representing units of latitude. One end of the string is held between your teeth and the other in a hand. You mark the altitude by pulling the string taut parallel to the ground and moving the card with the other hand until its top aligns with the target star, Polaris, and its bottom aligns with the horizon. The resulting number of knots sitting between your teeth and the card translates into the latitude. Used across the Indian Ocean until well into the 19th century, the kamal was deployed again in the late 20th century on a recreated voyage from Oman to China, and its effectiveness reconfirmed. Marco Polo mentions that Chinese navigators relied on a similar instrument, the Qianxing Ban, Polar Star Aiming Plates, which is a series of different-sized plates held at arm's length in such a way as to align top and bottom with star and horizon, respectively. The choice of plate depended on the altitude of the star. A millennium earlier, the Chinese estimated latitude with the Lian Tianqir, star-measuring ruler. The real sea change in navigation, however, came with the rapid spread of the seemingly magical magnetic compass. Now one could have an instant sense of direction, clouds or no clouds, stars or sun, day or night. Many countries have claimed authorship, or at least awareness of crucial components of the compass. Both the ancient Greeks and the ancient Chinese saw that certain brownish stones drew iron to them. The lode in lodestone, the magnetic form of the iron-rich mineral magnetite, is Old English for way. Some scholars confidently apply the term compass to objects that began to be used by Chinese navigators around AD 500, as sea routes to Japan were established, and the first mention of a south-pointing shipboard needle appears in a Chinese navigational text written in AD 1100. A resident of Amalfi, a southern Italian maritime power in the 12th century, has traditionally been credited with the invention of the north-pointing mariner's compass, and a contemporary chronicler described medieval Amalfi itself as famous for showing sailors the paths of the sea and sky. The first Arab text to mention a compass, written in the 13th century, calls the instrument by its Italian name. To some historians, the fact that the Chinese referred to south-seeking needles and the Italians to north-seeking ones suggests the likelihood of independent invention. Whatever the origins, compasses worked, and the way they worked was well understood in the Mediterranean by 1200, when a French writer described in detail how to rely on a compass to navigate by the star that never moves. This is the star that the sailors watch whenever they can, for by it they keep course. While all the other stars wheel round, this stands fixed and motionless. By the virtue of the magnet stone, they practice an art which cannot lie. Taking this ugly dark stone, to which iron will attach itself of its own accord, they find the right point on it, which they touch with a needle. Then they lay the needle in a straw and simply place it in water, where the straw makes it float. Its point then turns exactly to the star. There is never any doubt about it. It will never deceive. When the sea is dark and misty, so that neither star nor moon can be seen, they put a light beside the needle, and then they know their way. Its point is toward the star, so that the sailor knows how to steer. It is an art that never fails. In other words, float a magnetic iron needle by attaching it to something buoyant, and it will invariably come to rest along Earth's north-south magnetic axis, with its point aimed north. Soon came the pivoting compass needle and the compass's essential partner, a radial diagram called a compass card or wind rose, divided into as many as 64 directions. At sea, a direction meant a wind, and each wind bore a name. With the aid of this new technology, the literate, numerate ship's pilots sailing the Mediterranean or the Black Sea in the early 13th century could confidently determine not only when he was heading Tramontane, north, or Astro, south, Greco, northeast, or Scirocco, southeast, but also when he was heading Tramontane, quarter Greco. And he could keep to his course by dead reckoning, a mostly reliable technique based on knowing the relative positions of one's departure point and specific or general destination, as well as the direction of the vessel's movement and the distance traveled, both of which are determined at regular intervals. The pilot's sons and grandsons, continuing in the family profession, would have even more aids: scaled marine charts, and a pilot book filled with detailed sailing directions. Imagine you're the captain of a Venetian vessel in the year 1320. You've just brought in a load of grain from Egypt, and you're now heading to the east coast of Spain with some prized Sardinian cheeses and another shipload of grain. This one picked up at Constantinople. On the return trip, you'll carry Spanish wool. Your masters and the navies they support have thus far kept Portuguese ships out of your path, and neither the Black Death nor the mounted Ottoman Turks have yet arrived on European soil. Your exceptional nephew at the University of Bologna has told you of two groundbreaking books that he says are relevant to your profession, though you have no intention of reading them: Fibonacci's Book of Calculation and Sacrobosco's On the Sphere of the World. The former includes a reader-friendly introduction to Hindu Arabic numerals, including the indispensable zero. The latter is your era's preferred text for Astronomy 101. What you do read closely and keep with you on board is a hand-lettered copy of Lo Compasso di Navigare, which directs you on a clockwise circuit of the Mediterranean, and a Torletta di Martelloio, a series of tables showing you how to correct your course as you tack with the wind. You also have an exquisite Portolan chart of the whole sea, showing distances, harbors, and major landmarks. Is carefully scaled and even signed by an illustrious Jewish cartographer from Mallorca. On your oak table sit a pair of silver dividers and a silver ruler to work the chart. Your ship's compass, with its freely pivoting needle and its attached compass card, is safely housed inside a circular metal box. Your sunglasses, you keep some spares, were blown in Venice. Thanks to all this state-of-the-art equipment, you can figure out which direction your ship is heading. You can monitor the advancing and waning of night and thus the hours of the watch. And you know the distance to the nearest port, how many days sailing it would take to get there, and what to look for as you approach it. Unlike your Arab, Indian, Polynesian, and Chinese counterparts, you extract almost no information from the stars. And since you stay within the confines of your home sea, the Mediterranean, you find little cause to heed latitudes and even less to ponder longitude. But the known world had already reached well beyond the Mediterranean, and change was coming fast. Centuries had elapsed since the Vikings had begun to ship dried cod to Britain, since Icelanders had sojourned on Vinland, Newfoundland, since Polynesians had settled on New Zealand, and since the Chinese had crossed the Arabian Sea and learned that certain inhabitants of East Africa drank fresh ox blood mixed with milk. A handful of recent European-drawn maps had begun to show the southern half of Africa, which Ptolemy had hinted more than a millennium earlier, extended well below the equator. Plutarch knew Africa was circumnavigable, and Alexander the Great knew it could be reached by sea from the mouth of the Euphrates. But in the interim, it had, so to speak, gone missing. By the end of the 13th century, a Venetian had escorted a Mongol princess from the South China Sea to the Persian Gulf, and a Genoese had built a castle in the Canary Islands. By the end of the 14th century, Arab and Indian traders had established themselves along the East African coast as far south as present-day Mozambique. At the beginning of the 15th century, a heavily armed fleet of more than 300 Chinese vessels, commanded by the formidable eunuch Admiral Zhang He, and carrying nearly 28,000 soldiers and half a dozen astrologers, had sailed forth to impress and intimidate China's southern neighbors by a lavish display of both Ming treasures and military might. Last but certainly not least, from the perspective of Western Europe, the Portuguese had begun to sail the Atlantic far and wide. Portugal's Prince Henry the Navigator, born in 1394, dedicated himself to the discovery of Africa's River of Gold, to the erasure of Islam, to the gathering of slaves and pepper, and, according to the court chronicler of his day, to the fulfillment of his horoscope, the inclination of the heavenly wheels that inclined him to conquer new lands. His ascendant was Aries, which is the house of Mars and exaltation of the sun, and his lord is in the 11th house in the company of the sun. And because the said Mars was in Aquarius, which is the house of Saturn and in the mansion of hope, it is signified that the lord, Henry, should toil at high and mighty conquests, especially in seeking out things that were hidden from other men and secret, according to the nature of Saturn in whose house he is. And the fact of his being accompanied by the sun, as I said, and the sun being in the house of Jupiter, signified that all his traffic and his conquests would be loyally carried out. There are many rational, strategic reasons why one might invoke the universe in the name of conquest. You might want to stage a nighttime attack at the time of the new moon, giving you maximum darkness, as was done at the start of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. You might need to carefully monitor lunar tides during a naval invasion to ensure that your ships don't run aground in shallow waters. You might decide to invade during a phase of high auroral activity, which will muck up the other side's radio communication. The reasons ascribed to Prince Henry, anchored in the pseudoscience of astrology, are neither rational nor strategic. In his own day, it was well understood that Prince Henry, governor of the Wealthy Order of Christ, which had replaced the wealthy Knights Templar of earlier centuries, was undertaking a crusade, the quintessential fusion of war, profit-seeking, exploration, and the imposition of foreign ideas. Writing in the 20th century about space exploration, the American journalist William E. Burroughs called it a drive that was defined and tempered by politics and competition on every level, which could easily be said as well of Prince Henry's program. As Burroughs says, exploration was always done for the wrong reasons, but it was done. What he means, of course, is that whether or not the explorer is an explorer, exploration is hardly ever motivated by the desire to explore. Part the curtains of curiosity, and you'll find individuals hungry for political, cultural, or economic dominion funding the expedition. Henry and his actual navigators could not have done their venturing without astronomy, a fact made explicit in the florid decoration of noble works of Portuguese architecture executed during and shortly after his lifetime. The exuberantly sculptured window frames and archways, the floor mosaics, and ceiling paintings of the vast Convento de Cristo and elsewhere repeatedly present the astronomer's armillary sphere linked with the crusader's cross as well as with the vegetation of exotic lands. Historian Jorge Cañizares Esquerra captures the association between astronomical knowledge and conquest embodied by Prince Henry and succeeding generations of Iberian colonizers. The cosmographer as knight, or the knight as cosmographer, was a hallmark of the Portuguese and Spanish 15th and 16th century colonial expansion. The gathering of knowledge, he argues, was an expansion of crusading virtues. An influential mid-16th century book by a royal cosmographer, Arte de Navegar, presented ships' pilots as the new knights, whose horses were their vessels, and whose swords and shields were their compasses, charts, cross staffs, and astrolabes. Prince Henry's first conquest was Ceuta, a Mediterranean town in what is now Morocco, identified with the southerly Pillar of Hercules and piled high with African goods of great beauty and value. Under Henry's sponsorship and direction, many Atlantic islands, including the Azores, Canaries, and Madeiras, were tilled and grazed. Navigators in the prince's employ mastered a route around fearsome Cape Bajador, far out to sea and down past the Cape's winds and currents, and rounded the westernmost point of Africa, reaching as far as Sierra Leone. Along the way, the captains recorded star altitudes at notable capes, islands, and river mouths, which astronomers back in Portugal translated into tables of latitude. During Henry's 50th year fulfilling destiny, his brother, the King of Portugal, granted him monopolistic rights over the lands discovered and all enslavable persons therein. Henry's death in 1460 barely interrupted the travels of the Portuguese. In 1473, Lopez Gonçalves crossed the equator. In 1488, Bartolomeo Dias rounded the Cape of Storms at the southern tip of Africa. In 1498, Vasco da Gama reached southern India by sea. In 1500, 8 years after Columbus's first crossing of the Atlantic, Pedro Álvares Cabral arrived in Brazil. Their aims, like those of Henry and of the conquistadors who followed them, were to serve God and His Majesty, to give light to those who were in darkness, and to grow rich as all men desire to do. In short, they were laying the cornerstones of empire. Not that trade hadn't already made many people rich, as well as building a global economy across the old world. Consider this. The Muslim soldiers who fought in the Middle East against the Crusaders wore chain mail from the Caucasus and wielded steel swords smelted in South Asia from sub-Saharan iron. As the Ottoman caliphs extracted taxes and the Chinese emperors extracted tribute and invented paper money, merchants transported product from market to port and port to market. Much intercontinental trade was pan-Asian, private, and conducted by diasporas of blood, dialect, or faith. Jews, Hindus, Muslims, Armenians, Lebanese, Fujianese, Gujaratis. The Indian Ocean was the crossroads of a network of trading centers that stretched for thousands of miles, and local lords from the East China Sea to the eastern shores of Africa generally permitted merchants of every stripe and origin to enter their ports. But medieval Middle Eastern and Asian trade networks, however sprawling, were not colonial empires. The Muslim Caliphate settled for the collection of taxes hefty enough to fund the army that safeguarded the highways, which allowed for the commerce that yielded life's luxuries. And the Chinese state, which grew plenty of sugar and other tropical delights within its own borders, had little cause to put money, personnel, and effort into creating colonies overseas. The Portuguese, on the other hand, representing king, country, and God, sought both control and colonies. Good ships and newfangled guns gave them the advantage as they revived the practices of building forts, blocking trade routes, claiming trade monopolies, boarding foreign ships, and generally seeking to rule the waves and harbors. A key part of their program was to find routes free of Ottoman control, and thus free of Ottoman tax collectors. Venturing far across the Atlantic and Indian Oceans in the 15th century, the Portuguese had need of knowledge and instruments more elaborate than those used by the average captain crisscrossing the Mediterranean, or exploring the east coast of Africa, or taking soundings for depth, sampling bottom silt, and monitoring the tides in the fog-bound English Channel or the Baltic. Portugal's sailors may have been wary of unfamiliar concepts and new techniques, but Portugal's ocean-bound navigators had little choice other than to use the mounting numbers of charts, pilot books, and mathematical rules. Far more than their predecessors, they consulted the stars as well as the compass. Having mastered the art of dead reckoning, they continually checked their bearing against the height of the sun or the pole star as measured with a quadrant or mariner's astrolabe, and used arithmetic and geometry to recalculate that bearing when winds and currents threatened to send the ship off course. Instructions for the use of the quadrant cautioned that the pole star was not entirely stationary and should be observed only when its two guards lay east-west. Compilations of tables, known as ephemerides, listed the predicted daily position of the sky's major occupants. Tables of midday solar altitude in various cities helped navigators sail to the correct latitude and then keep to it as their ship headed due east or west, known as running down the latitude. The drive to amass navigational information that would grant an advantage over one's seagoing adversaries kept accelerating, and the stakes kept rising. Faith, glory, and commerce, writes the historian Emilia Viach da Costa, were the driving motives. The Pope himself pronounced Portugal's African project to be a just war, and three papal bulls concerning it were issued during Prince Henry's last 10 years of life. The first, in 1452, proclaimed the right of the Portuguese king to attack and enslave non-Christians and to confiscate their goods and lands. The second, in 1455, specified that this right applied to Africans from Morocco down to Cape Bojador, who had lived in perdition of soul and body, of their souls in that they were yet pagans without the custom of reasonable beings, and worst of all, through the great ignorance that was in them, in that they had no understanding of good, but only knew how to live in a bestial sloth. Translation: if you despise the way certain people live, you're entitled to take everything they own, and you're officially free to use force to do so. A quarter century after Henry's death, King João II of Portugal, O Príncipe Perfeito, the perfect prince, picked up where his uncle had left off. In 1484, he called together a group of savants from across Europe to work out rules for calculating latitude based on direct observation of the sun's midday altitude. Their findings were published in a comprehensive manual of navigation called the Regimento do Astrolabio e do Quadrante. It includes a list of latitudes spanning the territory from Lisbon to the equator, nearly all of which are correct to within half a degree. It even includes a translation of Sacrobosco's On the Sphere of the World. Word was getting around again. The world was not flat. Geographers began to wrap their maps around a globe, while astronomers kept themselves busy refining the coordinates of naturally occurring astronomical objects and phenomena. Besides seeking slaves, converts, and knowledge, the expeditions of the 15th century, the early part of what the maritime historian J.H. Parry calls the Age of Reconnaissance, sought gems and precious metals, spices and medicaments, good land for growing sugarcane, grapes, coffee, and tobacco, new fishing grounds, new pastures for sheep, new sources of timber of a suitable size for masts and palaces. But as each ship's hold filled with the products of faraway places, and each ship's captain returned to tell his tales to eager listeners, it became increasingly obvious that all this adventuring, conquering, colonizing, commodifying, and profiteering also required that every captain become expert at determining the exact location of his vessel, his destination, and his home. 15th century navigation was still a huge challenge. Few navigators could master the contents of the Regimento. There was no widely accepted north-south baseline against which to gauge distances east or west. There were no seaworthy chronometers and nothing approaching an odometer or speedometer. Quadrants and astrolabes, which depended on a stable gravity vector to stay vertical, were ill-suited to rough open seas. The compass needle had to be periodically remagnetized. And the problems didn't end there. Mariners suspected magnetic variation, but had no reliable means of isolating it, so they fiddled with the findings of their compasses in unhelpful ways. Without international standards of measurement, they used conflicting units of the mile, league, stade, and degree, so they ended up assigning varying equivalents to the distances noted in ancient literature. Their old-fashioned planar maritime charts suffered not only from a lack of up-to-date information, but also from a disregard for Earth's roundness. That roundness produces a, then mysterious, convergence of meridians as you approach the poles, which means that heading 60 leagues east along the equator will take you to a different meridian than if you headed 60 leagues east along the Tropic of Cancer. Yet as late as the late 17th century, a navigator could rely on a plane chart, lose his ship, and nonetheless become a fellow of the Royal Society. As for matters of hunger and health, a well-stocked expedition might carry enough pickled pork, salt fish, ship's biscuit, cheese, onions, and dried beans to fill the seamen's stomachs, and enough wine to give each man a liter and a half a day, but the casks of water soon turned foul, and scurvy took a heavy toll. Despite all the handicaps, with every voyage, Portugal's mariners and travelers added to empirical knowledge of what lay where in the western and eastern oceans, and what was seen when in the sky both above and below the equator. With every passing year, their findings and narratives revealed more errors in the maps and coordinates accompanying the much-read Latin translation of Ptolemy's 2nd century AD Greek Geographici that had come out in the first decade of the 15th century, and each round of errors triggered another round of updated maps and geographical treatises. At the respectable age of 41, having already sailed the Atlantic as far north as Iceland and as far south as Ghana, Christopher Columbus headed west from the Canary Islands on August 3, 1492, expecting that he and his fleet of three ships would come upon Japan within several weeks at a distance of some 4,000 kilometers and would subsequently reach the fabled Indies. The monarchs of Portugal, Spain, France, and England, and likely also the city-states of Genoa and Venice, had all turned down his proposition at least once. But after having second, third, and fourth thoughts on the matter, and after convening a group of experts who saw that Columbus had used the wrong version of the mile to calculate the circumference of the round earth, and had therefore come up with the wrong distance to his destination, Isabella I and Ferdinand II, already the rulers of Castile, Leon, Aragon, Majorca, Minorca, Sardinia, Sicily, and elsewhere, finally gave him the go-ahead to discover and subdue some islands and continent in the ocean on their behalf. That Columbus and his three-boat crew of 90 were not the first Europeans to cross the Atlantic does not diminish the ambitiousness of their agenda, the extent of their navigational challenges, or the magnitude of their eventual impact, no matter the errors of calculation or their failure to reach their intended destination. Nearly every man aboard was a seaman. None were soldiers, and weapons were few. Although he later complained that neither reason nor mathematics nor maps were of any use to me, Columbus had consulted maps, charts, globes, books, and instruments, especially the compass. He read Marco Polo's travels and the soon-to-be Pope Pius II's Historia Rerum Ubique Gestarum, based on Ptolemy's geography. He read and copied a June 1474 letter to the King of Portugal from the Italian cosmographer Paolo dal Pozzo Toscanelli, who declared that the shortest way to get from Lisbon to China was to head west across a nearly empty Atlantic rather than go around Africa, and that the distance in a straight line was nearly one-third the circumference of the earth. He and perhaps his honored cartographer brother, Bartholomew, read and extensively annotated Pierre Dailly's Cosmography Imago Mundi. Like many people of their time, whether learned or merely literate, they both almost certainly read the hugely popular Travels of Sir John Mandeville, a mid-14th century mishmash of fact, fiction, and faith. They studied recent world maps that suggested the possibility of heading west to arrive at the east. Bartholomew's own maps of the late 1480s, in fact, show that the brothers may have altered and invented a more attractive geography so as to more effectively persuade their royal patrons to fund the Indies expedition. Columbus consulted aids to reconnaissance willingly. The masters and pilots of his ships would have resisted both reading and calculation. Their expertise came from hands-on, hard-won experience maneuvering real vessels within sight of real eastern Atlantic coastlines. Yet even if every man aboard had been a mathematician and literary scholar, of what use were charts, handbooks, and sailing directions in unknown waters? Columbus therefore turned to dead reckoning, the pole star, and the compass. Star and compass read differently in different locations, however. Season, time of day, and latitude affect the former. Magnetic variation affects the latter, as Columbus found much to his distress. The needles declined northwest a full point. In the morning, the needles were true. The star appears to change its position, not the needles. Moreover, knowing only the relative easting and northing would get a navigator or land surveyor only so far. If he wished to record exactly where an impassable carpet of seaweed, a luxuriant pearl fishery, or a fortuitous defensive promontory lay, he had to know exactly how far east and north he was, and what he was east and north of. A sophisticated navigator might know how to calculate his craft's geometric relation to the sky's salient inhabitants, but to note a position in such a way as to be unambiguously and automatically understood, he needed a standard point of reference, two, in fact. He needed coordinates, a grid, a graticule with both an equator and a prime meridian at right angles to it. With its main parallel and its prime meridian crossing at the Aegean island of Rhodes, Eratosthenes' ancient world map had a grid that Hipparchus found arbitrary. Ptolemy's map, with its prime meridian passing through the westernmost known islands in the Atlantic, had a more astronomically inspired grid. The maps of Columbus's day, made for scholars and kings, and treated as classified information, had something of a grid, while the marine charts, made for sailors, had none. On the earliest surviving terrestrial globe, Martin Beheim's Erdapfel, Earth Apple, completed in 1492, there's a minimal grid that includes the equator, the tropics, and one meridian. When the New World entered the picture, the question of parallels and meridians got messier. When grabbing land, who is entitled to what, and who gets to decide, are not minor issues. For the crowns of Portugal, Spain, and Christendom, the choice of deciders was obvious, themselves. After all, the actual inhabitants of all that attractive New World real estate lived in perdition of soul and body, were filled with great ignorance, and had no understanding of good. So why ask them? In 1493, the Pope issued the first of a new spate of papal bulls meant to regulate the explorers' land seizures, giving Spain the lion's share of everything. Predictably, Portugal was unhappy. As a result, in 1494, Spain and Portugal, both Catholic nations, negotiated and signed the Treaty of Tordesillas, which was reinforced by a papal bull a dozen years later. The treaty fundamentally split the Western world in two. Everything east of a north-south line, 370 leagues west of the Cape Verde Islands, would belong to Portugal. And everything west of the line would belong to Spain. In 1529, in the Complementary Treaty of Zaragoza, the duo split the other side of the world along a line 297.5 leagues, or 17 degrees east of the Moluccas, the so-called Spice Islands, home of the prized clove tree. Portugal ended up with about 191 degrees worth of the world's girth, and Spain with about 169 degrees. So the conflicts carried on. The dividing lines that Spain, Portugal, and the Pope adopted had nothing to do with astronomy or mathematics or the science of geography. They were territorial markers, battle lines, private fences, announcements of yours and mine. Neither treaty served up a universal prime meridian. Meanwhile, Iberian expeditions proceeded apace.